Welcome to Telehealth and Medicine Today's unscripted podcast series where research and innovation collide. Today's topic is medical device cybersecurity standards, featuring Naomi Schwartz, Vice President, Regulatory Strategy at MedCrypt, Elizabeth Baker, Professor of Information Systems at Virginia Commonwealth University, moderated by Maria Palombini, Director, Healthcare and Life Sciences Global Practice Lead, IEEE Standards Association. Let's hear what they have to say.
Hello, I am Maria Palombini, the Global Health Director for Life Sciences at IEEE Standards Association, and I'm delighted today to come for you in this special podcast with Telehealth Medicine Today Unscripted. We have two awesome speakers who are going to share with you some unbelievable insights when it comes to the idea of cybersecurity, connected medical devices, and the overall healthcare ecosystem. So before I get started, one of the main reasons why we're really focused on cybersecurity, as all of you are already very well aware, is that we're seeing continuous breaches in our healthcare system from every aspect, whether it's from devices to actual breach of electronic health records, directly impacting our privacy and security. And with that, I've brought together two experts who work alongside as volunteers for the IEEE Standards Association, but as well are knee deep in this work, either from teaching and future engineers how to address this problem or actually working directly with devices and figuring out how do we make this all work well globally. So with that, I'm delighted to introduce to you two great speakers. First, Dr. Elizabeth Baker, who is a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she's also vice chair of the IEEE New Frontiers in the Continuum of Connected Care Incubation Program, and Naomi Schwartz, who is vice president, regulatory strategy at MedCrypt, who is also a vice chair of the IEEE Cybersecurity for Medical Devices Conformity Assessment Program. And for all the everyone who's not an IEEE person, these kind of program names will all come together as you listen to all the different ideas that our speakers are going to get to. So before we get into a real question format, I have asked each of these wonderful speakers to present an opening statement on the challenge at hand and what they're seeing from their perspective. So first, Elizabeth.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm thrilled to be here today because the concept of cybersecurity to me is so much more than just what we traditionally think. It's also the concept of safety. And so a lot of my work focuses on within healthcare, patient safety within the realm of clinical care. And part of that is cybersecurity and making sure that all of our systems work together in a safe and ethical manner, not just for the patients, but also for the clinicians. And so the standards work that we're doing is critical to ensure that there is a global level to which we expect our entire ecosystem to behave. And so that's exactly why I think it's very compelling that we talk about medical devices among many other different aspects of the system safety around patient care.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Naomi?
Yeah, I'd like to pull a thread on that and really focus on that idea that cybersecurity within medical devices and within healthcare more broadly is a patient safety issue. In fact, if you don't have cybersecure systems, you cannot have data sharing, interoperability, medical devices that work together that share data with other systems like EHRs that allow physicians to coordinate care across, in some cases, numerous specialists who are helping individual patients and who are dealing with hundreds and hundreds of patients, each of them on a daily basis, sometimes with overlap and sometimes with not, but also with caregivers and the patients themselves who should be empowered to keep track of their own data, to understand the state of their own health. All of those things are empowered by having cybersecure medical devices and all of the connected systems that work with them. And when they fail, we have a tragedy for a number of reasons, because we don't have interoperable data sharing, or it's not working the way it's intended. We have confidentiality breaches, but sometimes we also actually have immediate patient safety issues. You could have a patient who needs a device in order to sustain their life or in order to maintain their healthy state. People who live with diabetes have 24/7 maintenance of their condition, and it is in their own hands. Largely, they are supported by caregivers, they are supported by healthcare professionals, but they're taking charge of that on a daily basis themselves. And if they have a lack of availability, it hits home immediately. It affects their ability to work, to function, to care for themselves, their families, and everybody around them. So we need to make sure that these devices that are in the hands of patients, physicians, any healthcare practitioner, caregivers, that they are secure and that they work in the simplest fashion possible, and that patients don't have to do things to get their data off. Let me emphasize that. People hack their own devices because they can't get to the data that they need. That is unacceptable today. We have way too many options and mechanisms for getting data off and sharing them with the people who need to get that data. We need a secure way to do it, and people need their data liberated.
And that's a lot of good food for thought. And just for the audience, I didn't mention this in Naomi's introduction, but Naomi is a former FDA regulator working in that space. So she comes at it at multiple different angles in this conversation, which is excellent, by the way. All right, so everyone, you are all design technologists, engineers, meaning you, Elizabeth, you, Naomi, obviously. And when we talk about cybersecurity for the non-technical person, I'm talking about patients, clinicians, just your ordinary patient. When we say something, a device is vulnerable or not secure, what exactly are we saying? Elizabeth, you go first.
Yeah, so vulnerability is something. It's not a threat. We would call it in the parlance. It's not an attack. It's really a place where you have the ability to have something unsafe happen, right? So it's a potential place that you find that something wrong could happen, for lack of a better way of putting it. And wrong could be that your data gets exposed. So this could be something as simple as a device that communicates using Bluetooth, which we all use to our headphones, could get hijacked by another phone. Just like, I don't know, if you're sitting on the subway and someone is listening to their music via Bluetooth, you can actually listen to their music too. Like, most people don't do that, but you can do that if you really wanted to. Luckily, most people, what they listen to is not considered highly secure information, but if it were, it would be problematic. So that's what we mean. Vulnerability means that in some way, as you're using the system, as you're interacting with it, or even as the system just exists, it has inherent weaknesses that can be attenuated or not, but just inherent that make you vulnerable to something unsafe happening. Not necessarily to you specifically, directly health-wise, like it's not going to cause you to have some sort of reaction or whatever, but it could have some effect, like you've lost personal data that you don't wish to be in the ecosystem, or the device fails to work. I mean, that's another issue, right? Like it stops working. That may not harm you directly at that minute, but it would longer term. So that's why it's vulnerable. And so what cybersecurity is, to a layman, is the appreciation and action taken to address these vulnerabilities, right? All the things that we do to ensure that hazardous conditions don't happen.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of Mass Metro riders now trying to figure out how they can steal their neighbor's music and listen to it too now. I'm just kidding. All right. So, Naomi, how about from your angle? You come at it from multiple perspectives.
So fundamentally, with a medical device, we want it to work the way it's supposed to, and we don't want it to work in ways that it's not supposed to. We call those things requirements or negative requirements. We want certain things to not happen. I want my device to be available when I need it. So when I turn it on, I expect it to actually start up and go into the user mode that I'm expecting it to go into. We call that availability. I want to know that if I rely on a blood glucose meter to check my blood glucose levels with a finger stick, that every time I turn it on, it will be there. And if it's got a low battery, it will warn me so I can plug it in and I can take the actions needed as an individual operator to continue to make use of it when I need it. We have integrity concerns. We want to know that the system is giving me the right data at the right time. So if I have a Bluetooth medical device, I want to make sure that if I'm sitting in a room, maybe in a clinic with other people who have the same medical condition and may also use the same device, that I'm getting my data and not the data of the gentleman sitting to my left. And he doesn't want my data either, because if one of us is going high with blood sugar and the other is going low and we get our data crossed, we're going to make the wrong therapeutic decision. And that can have really significant consequences pretty quickly when we're talking about people who are insulin dependent. So we want integrity. We want to know the right data is coming to us at the right time. And we want to know that, our data is confidential. Some medical conditions are more sensitive to talk about than others. And if you have a sensitive medical condition, you do not want the person sitting next to you on the subway to know about your medical condition. You do not want your coworkers or your bosses to necessarily know. You have a right to that information being maintained as confidential between you and your caregiving team, and that should be protected for you. If it becomes available to other people, it may have no consequence, or it may have very severe consequences. It could lead to emotional harm. It could lead to financial harm. So those three elements are absolutely critical, and they are impossible to address after the fact. You have to consider them during design of the device to make sure that you've thought about where those weaknesses, those weak links in the chain that Elizabeth mentioned, might lie, so that you can design in features to protect those information pathways.
Yeah, you don't want it to be a firefighting response all the time. And a lot of the mistaken concern about cybersecurity is that it can only be happen. It can only be addressed once it's happened. And that's absolutely not true. It's not a break fix type of thing. Sure, that's part of it, but there's also a large amount of preventative work that you can do in devices specifically, not just in design, but in taking into account your context, your user. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that the engineers that we have designing these things are not the profile of the patient with the disease. And so you may, and it's as simple as I am programming something on an interface that has 10 point font when the average user is over 60 years old. Well, that's a really bad design decision in terms of, but to the engineer, if they don't really take into account who their patient population is going to be, that becomes a cybersecurity concern because of the interaction between the user and the device, right? That's a vulnerability that you can't read what is on the interface correctly. So it's not even as complicated as, oh, this really in-depth software, the innards. It really can be as basic as an interface that is not designed with the user population, but it's designed with the engineering population in mind. And that is where it leans into the ethics. Should we be making things that are, that are unsafe because we're not thinking about it, because we're not putting it in the right context? So, absolutely. I mean, these are things that it's not just a reaction. It can also be proactive work can also be done and must be done, right?
Right. And when you hear the regulators speak, and I'm going to defer to the regulators here being the United States Food and Drug Administration Center for Devices and Radiological Health for a second, but because of their collaborative work and the harmonization efforts worldwide, by saying FDA, I'm inferring Health Canada, EU MDR, the UK Medicines, the folks in Japan and China and Singapore and Australia, New Zealand and South Korea, who are very assertive about this, Brazil and other members of the MDSAP program, all of these regulators are looking today for some keywords. Secure by design is very commonly spoken at meetings when you hear these different regulatory bodies meeting together. And what it means, and what Elizabeth is alluding to, is that in your design phase, if you are capturing user needs and you're thinking about your user population, you're addressing things like cognitive dysfunction, which can occur to people who are having low blood glucose, Visual impairment, which happens for people who have degradation of their visual systems, which again, with people who live with diabetes, is a serious problem. But there are many other instances where people have these degradations of various systems, their hearing, their vision, their sense of smell, that can have impact to them. If you're not designing with those things in mind, with that patient population and their user needs in mind, you are going to create situations where they can't use the system the way they're supposed to. They're going to look for workarounds, and they're potentially going to find weaknesses that you did not protect against that they can exploit in order to find a way to make something work. So when we talk about cybersecurity, often there's a friction between cybersecurity and usability. If you do your design properly and you design cybersecurity in from the beginning, while considering the user population appropriately, you capture the two things and you reduce that friction significantly. Not perfectly, mind you, because there's always a trade-off there. There's trade-offs in any engineering. But if you identify requirements, what pieces of information have to be protected from the get-go, and how is the patient supposed to use them, and who do they have to share it with? You can design in requirements that say, I need to be interoperable. I have to share this with an EHR. There may be some middleware involved. All of the things that I'm going to create have to be able to talk securely to each other. How do I facilitate that? And then when you collaborate with the third party who created the EHR or the middleware, you'll negotiate what is the way that we do this secure handoff, and that will be secure by design, and it will have fewer, not perfect, but fewer weaknesses, as previously mentioned.
Well, and I also want to bring up the point to the user, right? A lot of times, medical device companies are for-profit companies, right? And so they're having to make a lot of decisions with their bottom line. And I think one of the things that is true of cybersecurity, but in particular device safety, is that it is actually cheaper to design without security first, because that's the way we've been doing it, and we don't need to spend money that we may not need to spend, because after all of these vulnerabilities are just potential threats. They're not actual threats, and we just need to deal with them when they actually happen. And what I would encourage to users and to people who are clamoring for such devices is that it is actually far less expensive to design with these vulnerabilities in mind. And so secure by design can also become a catchphrase, right? That is sort of paid lip service to, and you still design it and then you add the security on afterward, which is how most software and even software embedded in systems can be designed. But it's actually far less expensive to not have to do what we call use surveillance, which is where you monitor the marketplace for all the people who write in with complaints or problems or cybersecurity breaches, stuff like that. That is still part of the entire total cost of ownership, right? And so for you as a patient, this may not matter to you because it's not your balance sheet, right? It's this business's. But as an informed consumer, health consumer, you can say it's actually going to be far cheaper for you to avoid the accident than to have to pay the inevitable money for post-use surveillance.
Yeah, and if you take that a step further and you look at actual post-market enforcement, going back to those regulators, take a look at FDA's recalls website. Take a look at FDA's enforcement website. There have been a number of very high-profile cybersecurity recalls. There have been a handful of warning letters. I've got a few of them on my desk, related to cybersecurity. There have been consent decrees. There have been injunctions. These are court ordered actions that can cost companies billions, and I used a B there, big
No, it's
B,
true.
billions of dollars after the fact for failing to consider things at the design phase. So it may look cheaper, but I promise you it really isn't. And the probability of getting whacked with that stick is getting higher because the regulatory bodies are more and more aware of it, and because the failures that have happened have not yet led to the worst possible case scenario, but they've led to bad enough ones. In certain cases of not designing with the, state of the art at the time, there have been catastrophic failures, but these aren't necessarily cybersecurity related. People die when medical devices fail, when they're not designed properly, and that is not acceptable. And that has immense cost to the individual who dies, obviously, to their family members, to their employers who lose that knowledge base, who lose that skill set, to your colleagues, to your community. It costs money to the entire nation. It affects our GDP. If you want to get the economists involved, they can give you all sorts of cases for this. But it is fundamentally, capturing the attention of Congress even, that cybersecurity is patient safety. And if we are not investing properly today, we are in for an absolute avalanche of bad things happening tomorrow. So when we talk about investment decisions, it's not just the cost today. Total cost of ownership was mentioned. The cost of operations and maintenance have to be taken into account. Can you update your software? How can you update it? Do you have to send out a fleet of technicians with USB drives to do the maintenance, or can you push something over the air where you guarantee and you can measure how many of your devices have been updated, how many of them are not connected right now, how many of them have never been connected and won't be, and that you then have to send your fleet of technicians out to maintain. You are required by law to have a good understanding of those things in the post-market by a medical device regulator, required.
And I think the other thing that is really important, and this is where standards comes into play, and Naomi, I really want you to talk about this. I mean, standards from back in the day on software was a way for large companies to be able to level the playing field, right? They adhered to standards because they knew that those standards couldn't be a competitive advantage. And I guess to a lot of people, regulation may seem like, oh, well, this is going to hinder our ability to innovate or whatever. But standards occupy a really comfortable, nice middle ground between sort of doing nothing, about cybersecurity and having a regulatory hammer hit you. It allows you to see openly what the standards are that you have to comply with for it to be acceptable. And then after that, you can innovate. Right. But safety should not be something that we compete over. And so that's where I think that the standards really can help alleviate this idea that I've found a safe way to do it, but I'm not going to tell my competitor because it is going to cause me to lose my competitive advantage.
Sure. And the way that standards are developed by most international standards defining organizations, SDOs, is that they invite a broad set of stakeholders to the meetings and encourage all of those stakeholders to take part. You may have patient advocacy groups, you may have individual patients, you may have sort of bystander organizations who don't have a direct stake in the standard being developed, but who may connect to the systems that are developed under the standard. You may have very large manufacturers, very small ones, and intermediate sized manufacturers all showing up. You may have the supply chain showing up. So you might have, mobile medical app developers working with the mobile operating system developers in the standard to ensure that all of those different parts of the puzzle of development are taken into account. So when we talk about, for example, the conformity assessment program, for which I'm a vice chair, those stakeholders were all present in the room, and FDA was present in the room. So FDA as a regulator is saying, are you creating a standard that will actually help my review staff make good decisions about these medical devices? If it's not going to help us, not sure it helps anybody. Why bother? So let's negotiate these things, identify the critical elements that are going to support patient health, physicians who need to use the devices or who are going to prescribe them. The manufacturers will get consistency and will understand that if they do the things the standard calls out, that they will have a repeatable, predictable response from the notified bodies in Europe, from the FDA, from Health Canada, for example. And that predictability reduces uncertainty and cost in making decisions about how I'm going to design something and that I'm doing the right things. And it leads to consistency. All of the medical device manufacturers say, okay, we're going to use the same mechanism for wireless transmission and the same protocol. That means that you don't have one outlier who's like, oh, I'm going to use this other protocol that I wrote myself, that nobody can predict the behavior of, and that now you've got a cell phone that's like, I have to write a special little addition to the operating system just to talk to this thing. No joke, that does happen, and bespoke is usually bad. It's not helpful because nobody else can communicate with it and confirm that it's doing what it's supposed to.
But I've often heard, ladies, because I know you both work in standards and you both follow them and use them. Some have argued that, you following standards and developing standards sometimes can really choke innovation. Do you see it that way?
I don't, but it's because I think what people think innovation is they're stopping at a lack of imagination. And what I mean is that, all games have rules, right? And a lot of games have rules for player safety, right? I mean, it would be better if you didn't need to have those, but you do. And you get a lot of, chirping back and forth, about is this safe, is that safe, whatever. Should you even be playing the game, whatever. But ultimately, standards are just those rules of the game that on top of that, you show your excellence, you show your innovation. It's raising the level up so that everyone knows where to start from to compete. What lazier competitors will want to do is have fewer rules because then it's easier to figure out how to compete. But then what you've done is you've sacrificed your safety of your players, which in the long run just means you have fewer players and it brings into existential crisis, is your game going to exist? And in healthcare, the thing that is important about this and about stifling innovation and why we really have to encourage people to stop being lazy innovators is every single person is a consumer of medical care, everyone. Whether it's your mom giving you an aspirin or an ICU stay at a hospital, you're getting care. And in those actions of care, every one of them, there is a standard that that drug manufacturer or the packager or the delivery in the supply chain has to adhere to give you the sense that what you are doing to someone else is not going to be harmful. And that means every single person has a voice in the room of creating these standards. So when we talk about patient empowerment and the patient-centered care and all the things that the clinicians will hear ringing in their ears, this is a way to invest your patience in the quality. Like, we're not going to accept that people won't play by these rules that ensure our safety because it doesn't ensure, this is the important part, it doesn't ensure the existential nature of the device firm. It could if the recalls are so bad, but I mean, that's a risk that they calculate. It doesn't impact physicians because it's not working on them. It's working through them, and maybe it won't impact their license if something goes wrong, right? Maybe they don't have the liability. But from an ethical perspective, that shouldn't be sufficient because you don't have the perspective of the person upon whom the care is given or upon whom the device is used. And that is where we sit. And that's why I believe we hear so much resistance broadly to standards, and it stifles innovation because in a very lazy, argumentative way, it does. But it only does if you don't care about patient or player safety. If you care about that, you've just raised the floor of innovation, which nobody wants to do because it would be cheaper and easier to have the floor of innovation be lower. And this is not a academic argument. Like, I love the fact I'm an academic and we can argue everything that's pointless, but this is not an academic argument because hospital systems compete on safety. And that sounds ridiculous, but it's absolutely true, meaning that one of them can come up with a safety innovation and use it that helps patients stay alive or avoid major harm, and they don't share it because it's a competitive advantage of their hospital. There is a different way of doing it, and in the US, this is true with children's hospitals. They've all agreed that the top 16, I think it's maybe even 20 now, children's hospitals have agreed that they will all voluntarily disclose safety innovations to each other because they're like, we're not going to compete on safety amongst each other. These are children, we can't do this. But we've not made the same argument for adult hospitals. And I just think it's important then to say this is not an academic argument. Like we have it right now in a different healthcare competitive market, and that is of institutional care. And so we don't want it in medical devices, right? It's easier because it's a product as opposed to a service. And so, standards of service are very different, handled. But I think that's why I want to compel everybody to care, is because this is not a given that people are going to, I won't say do the right thing because that's pejorative, but I'll say incentivized to take into account people who aren't directly involved in the value chain.
Yeah, and for people who say, okay, the standard is going to suppress my innovative approach, I would say, are you involved in the standard? You can help direct it.
Absolutely.
Some standards have mandatory elements and others are optional. If you have an innovative approach to something and it's not covered by the way that the standard is written today, rather than saying it's useless, I don't want to follow it. And in the United States, these are voluntary consensus standards. You don't have to follow them. You'll have to show an equivalent demonstration of safety, effectiveness, and security. But you don't have to follow them. But if you do follow them and you participate, you can influence them. You can direct them. You can say, hey, you're missing three elements. If you added these three elements, it will cover the way that my device is designed. And we can demonstrate to everybody that we still have safety, effectiveness, and security in those devices. Now you've moved the bar and you've allowed it to accommodate for your innovative approach that is different than your three other competitors. Now you have a competitive advantage and a standard that is working better for the community. And the entire community is now aware that there may be other ways to do things that they hadn't considered, but you haven't told them how. You've just told them what data you're producing and how you're going to share it. And now you're maybe producing a situation where the entire patient community gets that floor raised because there's a new way to do something that helps them, that improves their standard of care. I'm all for that. And I have heard companies say, well, standards are only useful if they get me through the regulatory body faster. I totally understand that. If that's the case, and you're seeing that the regulator is in the way, you need to stand up and say something at a public meeting and say, hey, regulators, why don't you consider the Bluetooth special interest group's output to be like a standard? It's technically an SDO. It's an international consensus group. They have great work products that are tied to other standards, like step up and make it work. Personally, I'm publicly saying things like that because I do think that there's a time and a place for people to leverage these things. And, if that facilitates interoperability and innovation, let's go. Get out of the way. Let's make it happen. But the only time that occurs is when innovators realize that something's blocking them and say something. And do something about it rather than, oh, whining about it and complaining that that's slowing them down.
Or be concerned that their trade secret's going to be hijacked. I mean, that's the real concern for them. And it's like, well, then you're not, the creative friction between the standards folks is not to be stepped down. It's to create a synthesis that raises it up. And I think that's what I mean by lazy. Like, don't sit there and just sort of complain about it. Like, take the friction you're getting and rise above. Like, bring the whole conversation up. Don't decide to just take your toys and go home and badmouth what it is. Like,
That's right.
assume being in the arena will make you better. But if you're not there, your point is well taken. If you're not there, we're not trying to do anything against you. We don't know what we're doing that's against you. Like, we
Right.
don't
We
have any concept.
haven't heard your point of view. We can't account for it as a
Right.
consequence. And quite frankly, if the regulator's in the room and they're hearing about regulatory impedance to an innovation, they will take that back to their
100%.
leadership and talk about it and try and find ways to get out of your way. The regulatory bodies are not solely existing to be in the way. That is obviously one way that people perceive them,
Right.
but that's not their purpose.
It's hard to appreciate that they are the voice of the valueless entity in the system, right? I mean, it's It sounds terrible, but I mean, companies are not always necessarily thinking about their users beyond their marketing slogans, right? Engineers are not in the room, and if you don't think that's the case, then tell me why I can't in my pencil skirt get into my SUV.
That's
Okay,
right.
like the engineers are not in the room. I need my four-wheel drive to get
What
through
an
the
analogy
snow
in that one,
and
though.
Target, right? So like, the regulators are the people in the room that say, hey, you're going to have people that are not 6'1 getting into this car, and maybe we should have some safety issues, because if there's an accident, that 5'1 person is going to have a different physiological response than a 6'1 person, right? But the only way I know about that, because I'm not thinking about a crash, I'm just someone who wants to get into my, truck and drive it without having to kind of cantilever myself in with what I'm wearing, that I'm like, oh, hey, I can get in my car easier. They're thinking about me, and that makes me want to buy that car. And if you think people haven't bought a car because of the fact there's a step to get into the car, you're wrong. I mean, you're just wrong. And so it's that simple about medical devices too. Like, your user, the regulators are for that one person who isn't in the value chain. We are not the designers. We are not the people who are making profit off of it. We simply are people who are impacted indirectly, because it is typically doctors who choose these devices for us, not us, right? So we're just using them, and it's like, oh, like, there needs to be a voice for us, because we're not doctors, we're not engineers, we're not technically adept, but we're the very people whose safety is on the line in the use of these things. And so I bring in car design just because it's something everybody's familiar with and has, it's a funny anecdote, but it's a very serious one. I mean, the driver of a car has no concept about how it's been designed to be crumple safe. Right. No, nobody knows that. Or, I mean, only disaster people like me think about it, right? I mean, patient safety people, right? We don't think about it. But when you're making a standard for a crumple safe car, you have doctors in the room. You have EMTs in the room, because they have to extract the people out of those cars. You have everybody in the room, sometimes drivers, sometimes not, right? Typically, it's survivors of people who didn't make it through the crash. But that's why it's so critical. Like, regulators are only keeping you from innovating because they're bringing the voice in of someone who doesn't have your technical expertise, but has as much on the line as you do as an outcome. And yeah, people don't like that. I mean, but ultimately, that's the point of. I mean, it sort of, I guess, philosophically, it gets into what you think government's role is, or what you think a regulator's role is. But ultimately, because 100% of all users, of all people, are healthcare consumers, 100%, this is a completely addressable market. It becomes an even more important conversation, because you're going to have these entities globally in all sorts of areas. But if we can use standards in a way that everyone appreciates that we're taking up for someone who isn't there, but it's critical. I mean, you can't kill your user base, or harm them.
Important.
I mean, well, I mean, you can. We've had pharmaceuticals that do it, right? But
A bad idea.
it's a bad idea.
Very
That's
bad
right.
idea.
So I think that's kind of the idea about why standards and this whole anti-innovation argument. It may look like the same outcome, but it's the wrong reasoning. They're assigning to regulators the wrong reasoning, and that is, they're not trying to stifle your innovation. They're trying to take up for someone who's not in your design room or in your clinical decision support room, and they have to do that because of the safety involved of that person. The doctor survives a medical device injury. The company survives a medical device injury. The user doesn't survive a medical device injury. And so someone's got to be in the room talking to that person.
Very important. So, Naomi, I'm going to ask you because I can't believe how fast this great conversation has gone. And we've already been, I think, almost 30 minutes. So, Naomi, I'm going to ask you to maybe put the final comment in and then we'll have to wrap it up. Although I have like tens and dozens of more questions for you both, but this could take all day. So.
Sure. So fundamentally, when you're thinking about a medical device that's going to have to be used in a patient care environment, whether it's a home user or in a hospital or in a hospital at home use case scenario, what you want to think about is what is its purpose? What is it supposed to be doing? How is it going to be connected? Am I monitoring somebody? Am I treating them continuously? Am I treating them intermittently? What is its intended functionality supposed to be, and how do I protect that functionality? How do I ensure its availability for use when I need it? If it's 24/7, how do I ensure that it's available as much as possible and warns me before it goes into some downtime? How do I make sure that it has a long lifespan? I don't want to buy a product and spend thousands of dollars on that medical device and find out in a year and a half that it is no longer going to be able to function for me. So I want some indication from the manufacturer that it will be supported for a certain period of time. I want some predictability in there. If I'm in procurement and I'm deciding what to buy, I want some sense if I'm a buyer, what those security elements are and what proportion of the security actions need to be taken by me as an end user or by my IT security staff as a hospital or by the individual patient if it's going into a patient's home. And I need to account for whether or not they're capable of managing those responsibilities. Because if they're not, then those responsibilities should not be deferred by the manufacturer. They should be managed by the manufacturer in the design process. So if you're designing a new medical device, please start taking those things into account and realize that if you don't do it now, when you try to bring your medical device to market, your procurement may run into the friction of the buyer saying, I won't buy it. It's not secure. Prove it to me. Show me some data that says it is secure. Tell me what standards you followed. Tell me, in a disclosure form, what you did to secure it. Tell me what's in the software bill of materials. What'd you use to build it? It's like a package of Legos. There's a little chart at the end that shows you all the pieces, the colors, the shapes, the sizes, how many there are supposed to be. If you can't give me that, I don't know that I can actually trust this thing to work the way it's supposed to. The FDA started asking for VEX data, which is a vulnerability exposure statement about your software bill of materials. Tell me if any of those Legos are prone to breaking, like the little brown ones that always break on my son, right? If there's one in there that is prone to breaking, you need to tell me why I don't have to worry about that having a safety impact. If you can't do that, I don't want to buy your product. If you're designing new medical devices today, start thinking about those things early, build them into your process throughout, tie them into your entire quality management system, and you will be successful to the extent that you can be. You won't have any earned failures, let's put it that way. If you don't do that, you are earning, you are asking for, you are begging for those firefighter moments. And I've been through a bunch of those while I was at FDA and since, and they are not enjoyable. You do not want to run around with your hair on fire trying to figure out how you put it out. It's not a productive approach. So start building them in today. Leverage standards. If they're not working for you, go fix them. Participate in them.
Yep. Wow. Very well said, Naomi and Elizabeth. Thank you. So I just for all of you out there, these are my key takeaways from this conversation. You probably all have your own as you listen to this, but we know globally more and more patients and doctors want us to do hospital at home, more remote care, which means more and more devices are connected and out there, which means our vulnerabilities are going up. But from this conversation, these are my key takeaways, and I hope you all find more. But number one is we don't have to think about cybersecurity as an IT issue. It's a patient safety issue, which means all of us should be vested, I think, in figuring out how do we solve this. The second one is I think the reality is that we shouldn't look at standards as a way of choking innovation, but as setting the bar higher for innovation and demonstrating that patient security and safety is a priority, which I think would be a great marketing tool for all you medical device manufacturers out there. And finally, I think it's really important, and I think both Elizabeth and Naomi really emphasize this, is the concept of proactivity, right? Be proactive in your design. Be ready to, obviously you want to design. It might not be the most cost-effective manner, but in the long run, I think it'll save you both financially, economically, and a lot of heartache if you are proactively designing upfront. And if anybody's interested, and as Naomi mentioned, if you want to have a voice and you're interested in participating in standards, you don't have to be an engineer. You don't have to be a technologist. You bring your expertise and you can reflect your expertise in the development of the standards so your voice is reflected as we develop it and publish it. And so with that, I want to again thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Naomi, for a great conversation. I wish we had more time. And obviously, I want to thank Telehealth Medicine today for the opportunity to share with you, with their audience and all of you, this great conversation about why cybersecurity is a very important aspect we all have to consider in the use of devices. So with that, I wish you all very well.
We appreciate you tuning in to the Telehealth and Medicine Today podcast series. Do you want to learn more or have a comment? Do you have a novel topic or solution to share with our audience? If so, send an email to info@partnersindigitalhealth.com or visit the open access peer-reviewed journal, Telehealth and Medicine Today, and stay up to date with exciting articles that bridge research with real-world frontline impact. Thanks for listening.